to when it's repressed. So that's a journey for me. And I, the biggest situation I would say is I had my daughter, there was a crisis with the police jumping some young people at a park, and they beat them up pretty bad. And it was happening pretty often. So I went up there, I had my daughter in the car, and I stayed in the car, I had a young person stay in the car with my daughter while we filmed the police. We had undercover lawyers, undercover reporters there to witness the situation. And that was the last day. I think my daughter was 5 years old. That was the last day I've ever shown up on site again since I've been a parent in a crisis. Now I send people, I delegate. I've learned the art of delegation when it comes to crisis. I said, this is not healthy. It was late taking my child out. I can't roll like that anymore. And let other people do it. So that's how it's shifted, where I've had to, my daughter had brought it to my attention, the reality of I am a parent and I can't, I'm not a savior. I can't save the world. I need to deal with my own household first.
Yeah, that's a lot of parallels, I would have to say. For me, I mean, I think about as Black parents always tell you is that kind of thing where, you know, a lot of white people don't understand that we're taught to work twice as hard. You got to do that to get ahead. And so I always had that in the back of my head. And so I put a lot of pressure on myself to be successful. And I got into the corporate world. And I soon realized that as you move up, there's less people that look like you. And so many instances in many spaces, I was the only Black female Anglophone. And I didn't know what was happening at that time. Now we have words to address it, like microaggression and macroaggressions. But I didn't know what this was that I was feeling at the time. I just felt I was purposely excluded. I was, there's a lot of stuff going on, you know, treated a certain way versus my counterparts. You know, I am a very assertive person, but it was taken as me being aggressive or I'm angry when I am reacting in the same way that of my as my counterparts. So in the corporate world, you know, you're moving, you're navigating and just trying to survive, right? I had my two daughters at a young age. And so again, the stereotype of, you know, this young Black mother. So I always was pushing myself to prove myself and prove my worth. And that is because I'm a product of my environment. So always at the same time in community volunteering, because I felt that was important. In 2020, when our company were on furlough, I was working in the aerospace industry, and they were first hit by the pandemic. And I had an opportunity to be at home for 5 months. And I just said, is this where I want to be? Is this what I want to do? I mean, I'm still volunteering. At that time, I was the chairperson of the West Island Black Community Association. So I'm still giving, but this is on a volunteer basis. This is not my 9-to-5. So at that time, they called us back. There was 300 employees. They called back to only 60 something. And I was one of those 60 something. You're happy. But at the same time, I'm like, wow, now I have to go back to this environment that I never felt safe in. An opportunity presented itself to work in a school as a community development agent. And it's the first time I saw myself on a piece of paper. Everything that I felt that I wanted to do was there. So I applied and I got into the school, and that was in 2020. And I have to say that when I'm in the school system, I see the children in the school and I see what they're going through. And I think back about when my daughters were in the school system, had I known what was going on, and I mean, you know, I think that inherently everyone means well, especially if you're working in the educational system, you mean well, you're there for the kids, but not understanding your biases and the impact on the students is detrimental to what they, how they see themselves and how they're able to achieve in school and then after that. So I'm glad to be in this time where I'm able to impact directly to youth, and glad to be here with Rowan and sharing this experience, because there's so much to be done in this, in Montreal, in Quebec, and across, but we live here, there's so much to be done, and we're just trying to figure out how we're going to be able to ultimately support not just Black people, but all members of all people that are marginalized, because those are the ones who, again, have to work, you know, 10 times harder to be able to get to the same level as the majority. So that's pretty much it.
Yeah. It sounds like both of you are very successful, but you face like these insane aggressions in your community. And as a young Black person, I just would like to know, how do we not be scared of that? Like, how do you transfer your skills to other people so they're not scared to succeed later in life?
That's a good question. I think you have to identify it first, right? It's never going to be easy, because every day I wake up, I was like, sometimes I wake up really, really motivated, and sometimes I wake up feeling defeated. So I don't think there's a right or wrong answer to that. I think with experience and just like, if you spoke to me when I was 30, I wouldn't be responding in the same way, because you're continuously evolving and learning and growing. And I think number one, what Rowan said, it's so important to take care of yourself. I didn't have a full out burnout, but I would say last year I was I was very close to having one. And this had nothing to do with work. This had to do with community. This had to do with giving your all to community. And it's just like a never ending road. It doesn't ever end. There's always someone that needs help. There's always someone that needs your support. And community work is not a 9-to-5. Anyone that works in community knows it is not a 9-to-5. So I think, number one, take care of yourself. Be open-minded. Listen to when people present their experience, really believe them, right? In the working environment, I feel like sometimes gaslighting happens on a regular, and sometimes you question yourself, like, am I reading this wrong? But no, actually you're not. So I would say, you know, be open-minded, have those conversations, learn. If you feel something, it's probably true. And I don't know. I think our community needs a lot of healing. Okay. I think our community needs a lot of healing. And there's a lot of conversations we have to have amongst ourselves. So I think that once we work collectively, and you know what? Sometimes some people, we're going to have to just leave them because they're not interested in the betterment of the community. And that's fine. But I think the conversation starts with us.
I would say definitely it's looking at our position and pivoting if you have to. Pausing first and then pivoting. So there's a triple P right there. But I use those words because if you think of even like the pandemic where people who were freaking out in that moment, you know, there was people who just had to pause to save their sanity and ground themselves, and other people who had to pivot to save themselves. So like, okay, even businesses who are thriving were like, okay, I can no longer do this because people can't come here. What can I do to make sure my business thrives? I do that for myself. I went through a part of my career where I noticed that nothing was changing, where I felt it was just a revolving door of the same nonsense after all these meetings, even the community. I'm like, what am I doing here? How can I serve better? Because I was used to, like I said, the intervention. I was doing it well. This happens. Here's the remedy. Next, revolving door. But I'm like, okay, instead of being it's like our medical system, instead of just maybe giving things that's just going to pacify or suppress the symptoms, how can we make sure that we prevent people from getting in a situation in the first place and not have that lineup at the door? So I give that situation to say that I remember a principal, there was a kid had a stink bomb or something in the lockers and they kept doing it. And one of them was very dangerous. And the two of the students was from, they were from an Italian background. And we all knew who did it because the kids tell us everything. But the teachers and the principal didn't. And they ended up expelling this Filipino young man. And I went to the principal, said, we know who did it. Everybody knows who did it. It was not this young man. And the principal did not look up at me. And she goes, well, the mother didn't have an issue. Why do you? And I teach anger management, by the way. I went to flip her desk, flip a couple of other things. I was so angry. I almost walked out. Teachers had to literally pull me back. I was like, I'm done with this. And the thing is, with that student who comes from that background, that those parents look at principals and teachers as gods. Like, you are up here. We do not disrespect you. Whatever you say goes. And she was like, thank you very much, bowed her head and left with her son. And all I could think of, that's on his record. And she knew, because in the end, that those two boys, their parent had connections at the school board. And you see this often. And I'll expose it straight up, no business, on air.
Nepotism,
but it's, yeah. Yes, the nepotism. They like, well, you know, we don't want to ruffle feathers. We don't want to do that. And that's what happens a lot of, in our community, in the BIPOC community, where parents do not feel empowered. Mm-hmm. As I've had parents who have said, hey, you need to do this. Go to the regional director. They just rather change your kid's school and leave it all behind them, because just the thought of doing something to resolve this issue is draining, triggering. It brings up that trauma, whether it's like, they went for a job and someone says, go on welfare, because that's happened to me. So for me, it's really a challenge to help empower these young people when you're in it. But then I have to tell myself, change the lens, change your perspective of the situation. And I had to do that to save my sanity. I remember saying, okay, let me stay on more with the school. I'm going to get my master's. And then, nah, what can I do now? Mm-hmm. It's pivot. When you're in a situation and you are dealing with somebody who's aggressive, or you're dealing with an employer who's saying certain things is abusive to you, or you don't feel healthy, it's time to change a job. And if that's anything I've learned from millennials and Gen Zs, they're not waiting for that security. Mm-hmm. They're like, bet, I'm out. You're like, but shouldn't you find some security? Because, you know, I'm squished in between the boomers, and that's what they tell you. Work 25 years. Endure whatever it takes, because you got to put food on the table. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm willing now to flip the script and not have food on the table in order not to be abused, because I will not be any good to anyone else. So it's
also,
really changing.
It's also what you're showing your children, right? What you're showing your kids or anyone around you is that if you're accepting that abuse, because that's really what I call it, you're accepting that abuse, and you're going to see that they're going to repeat the same thing. They're going to accept it because of a certain salary, right? So sometimes we have to get uncomfortable.
We did the same thing our parents did.
We did it. Sometimes you have to, it's difficult to say, but being... You know, again, I, you know, would love to have a certain standard of life. I want to have this and I want to have that. But at what cost? At what cost are you willing to say, well, I want that car, I want that house, to be abused, you know, in the workforce, or abused in whatever environment that you're in? You know, if you're not going to accept an abusive relationship, why would you accept an abusive employer? You know, it comes down to that. And again, with age, because I wouldn't be saying this when I was in my 30s.
No.
But now I'm just like, you know what? Unapologetic. This is not okay. And to call it out. And but it can't just be our fight. It has to be, you know, but even outside the community, because we didn't create this problem. It is not our problem. We are just on the receiving end of it. But who can make the change? So we're always on the front lines, right? But we need allies, and even beyond allies, we need accomplices, because they will use their privilege to be able to make the change. So I think it's important for us to make people, hold people accountable. Politicians, police, you know, everyone needs to be held accountable, because they all have a part in this thing called anti-Black racism. They all have a part in it, subconscious or not. So we're moving forward to
and we know you're rogue. I know she didn't mean to say when she said accomplice, because there's no crime here. But yeah, we definitely need, I think you meant allies and I guess partners or people to be a part of it. Like,
no, but accomplices. So what, like there's allyship. Yeah. So there's allyship where you're saying you're going to go protest with that person. Mm-hmm. When you become an accomplice to,
I think it's another word, because accomplice, you're doing a crime together. An accomplice with you. So more
but
of
you're
a
with that person.
Yeah. Right? You're with that person. With that I can't remember the word. Yeah.
For the fight.
Yes.
But
yes.
Using your, so that's the thing. I don't mean to.
I can't find a word. Don't worry. No heads rolling here. So no, I think that's a great point, is we definitely need people to be in alliance with us, and we're not doing it in silos, because there are grassroots organizations who are not BIPOC, who are there to serve. And when you hear people having conversations like, how can we step up? That is a beautiful thing. Mm-hmm. And they recognize that I may not understand. That is that beautiful thing again of empathy. I have a heart of compassion, but I want to do this in the right way. And when they reach out to us and ask those questions, it's And it's genuine. We know when it's genuine. It's like, okay, well, we're learning as well, because our script, our frame of mind, the scripts that we've learned in the 80s and 90s, it's not applicable.
No, it's not.
What was applicable even 2 years ago mm-hmm. is very different now. Exactly. So, yeah, that's very important for us as well to revisit in a shifting climate, as we see mm-hmm. when we look at, I say to educators, it cannot be easy. When you're teaching, what we've learned in 20 years is different than what we've learned in 3 years. Mm-hmm. Whether it's seeing gender fluidity, whether it's pronouns, and we're having these different conversations, and okay, do we say the N-word when we're teaching or not? Like, it's just very static, but it's like, okay, I know that what I mean and what my intentions are, but how do I do this appropriately? Mm-hmm. And we have the conversation in a way that's non-judgmental.
Yeah, and understanding that, because a lot of times, people will get, one Black person says one thing, they assume you're speaking for the entire race. You cannot speak for the entire race. Just like I'm not going to assume a white person speaking for the entire race. So I think that's the number one issue, is that we're not all going to agree on the same thing. And that is because we're not all the same. Within the Black community, if you want to speak about language and country, like, we're so different. Even within one country, one continent, how many countries are in Africa? Like, you cannot make that. So making that assumption is the number one mistake. We don't all speak with the same voice. Not all the time. And we have to understand that, I'm going to say it, you may have individuals, people of color in certain positions. They don't necessarily speak for me.
Facts.
And I will, I'm not going to name any names, but there was a politician, a Black politician, that when I was speaking about systemic racism and, the need to address it head on, he literally said to me, "You know what, Kemba, let's not get caught up with adjectives. You are representing me." So my point is, we there's different people in different positions. They're not all working for us. And we need to acknowledge that, So I don't know.
You people don't mean you about the people.
No, it does. It does not. So there's a lot of work to be done. Will it happen in my lifetime? I personally don't think so. But, we nurture the youth to then take it from there. Our parents, our grandparents, everyone, every generation has that fight. And we hope that it moves the issues forward. But you know what? Sometimes when I look at protests from back in the 50s, I really don't see any difference than now. The only difference I actually really see are when they used to hose you down with the and the dogs. Mm-hmm. But apart from that, it is the same fight.
Same fight.
It's the same fight. And this, to me, is what is disturbing. Because what are we really shifting forward then? If people are still using the N-word, or people are asking questions, why do we have Black History Month? If that's still being a question, then I don't know what it is that we're not doing. I don't know. But what I do know is that I need our peers, and I need our friends and our allies to stand with us and actually step ahead of us and fight. Because we can change a system that is meant to break us. They can change it. Yeah.
All we can do is help those one who are injured and help prevent them from being injured. Like, when I see my focus very much, my story is very ingrained with mental health. My mom was diagnosed schizophrenic, my sister as well, still hospitalized 20 years later. And myself dealing with general anxiety over the years. And all I see is young people suffering with mental health issues. And this is a generation that speaks up more. So they'll express it. We'll see it. But what are we doing about it? So when I think of, even when we look at the news, a war that is doesn't look like it's even connected to remotely Black people, and you see the images of mm-hmm. Africans or people from the Caribbean not being able to get on trains and get out of a country because they're Black. I can't imagine young people being in their social media feed and they're Black and saying, wait. Even in a time where people should just be running for their freedom, they're like mm-hmm. taking a moment, say, no, not you. You still end up in the bottom of the barrel.
Yes.
You still get the brunt of all of this. That in itself, it's mind blowing. During a pandemic, everything was like Blackness again. It became about our fight. Mm-hmm. And that's what I that's resounded with me, what Kemba said, is how do we help our young people? Mm-hmm. Not just them, but myself too, where I'm like, how do we thrive in all of this? And I think that's the key for me. It's like, I may not be able to pull the banner, and I don't want to pull the Black community on my back. Trust me, I'm quick to be like, I'd rather stay home. I'm not protesting. I can't handle the pressure. Mm-hmm. Facts. That's where I'm at. And that kind of saves my sanity. When another Black young man is stabbed before school, and then the conversation, well, he's from a gang, and then he can't get, his family can't get any money because of the situation. It's like, I kind of have to numb myself in order to move forward. But the young people, it's like, okay, I need you to be able to go 10 steps forward today.
And then on that note, similar situation in the West Island, and you've never heard gang come up ever in that conversation about what happened, right? It's blatantly in our face. It's blatantly in our face. But if we dare call it out, you know, you have responses like, why does it always have to be about race? Why? Because it is.
Look right now in the media, when we're speaking about what's happening in Ukraine, they're like, these are not people in the Middle East. These are not Syrian refugees.
They're not nationals.
These are Europeans. Yeah. These are good people. And I'm like, and I don't know why I'm shocked to this day, but I've heard 5 different interviews, journalists speak this way, and I'm shocked every single time. Like, they're saying this out loud, even if you haven't, but they're saying it out loud. And that shows that it's embedded, it's ingrained.
And it's accepted.
And it's accepted. It's on air.
I'm tired of waking up angry. It's definitely not healthy. And race-based trauma is real. And I never understood why do I have that chip on my shoulder? I never understood it. But I understand it now, you know, so.
And I will say, when you speak of race-based trauma, I didn't encapsulate it as much as well until George Floyd. I created a piece called I'm a Witness. And not because I wanted to write another Black poem about another Black man getting killed by the police. Because I was tired. I said, I'm never doing this again. I'm done. Because it's the same repetitive of what I'm going to just photocopy the same poem. Mm-hmm. But then when I saw the whole cancel culture and the shifting tides and how people were attacking each other, I was like, what is happening? And it feels very just like right now when we're seeing with the vaccine, I call it vax on, vax off, wax on, wax off, mask on, mask off. And people are fighting. I'm like, yo, people are dying in the streets. And this is what we're doing, attacking each other. Mm-hmm. So when I go back to when I wrote that piece, I'm a Witness, I'm realizing this is the first time that over and over we see images of Black men being killed live on TV. Mm-hmm. You don't see that by nobody else. Think about it. There's no reference point. It's like, oh, this is too graphic. So we have been also allowed to get fed to the points normalized to see ourselves being literally lynched over and over and over in 2020, 2021, 2022, if you think of it. And even if you, I don't watch news, I still see the images because it's all over. So I think of the young people, what does that inform in their minds of who they are and who they will be? When you already have your parents saying, you better be careful when you go outside, don't hang out too late, come straight home, don't stay outside, take your hoodie off, don't even wear the hoodie.
And you then you look like a criminal. They're supposed to be successful in school, right? You're supposed to be that academic. You're supposed to be that person to get the, I forgot what they call it.
The scholarship.
The whatever, right?
The accolades.
But you're just trying to survive. Mm-hmm. And you step in that school and the first thing you want to say, take off your hoodie. Pull up your pants. I've seen it in Winston's. What does that, those pants lower, is that impacting their education? When I look at policies in the school and the policy states no do-rag, that's an attack on a specific community. How is that possible to do that? You will never see them do that to any other culture, any other community, but it's done to us.
Well, then again, we're also in the province of Quebec, where some of these things have come up, certain bills being passed, you know, where no head covering. And the sad part is being Canadian, like when I do speeches, I say, I love being Canadian. I love being from Montreal. I grew up and I went to Camp B'nai B'rith. I can spit Hebrew. I love Lebanese food. I love going in spaces where all rich cultures are there. Mm-hmm. I can speak about different faiths. That's what Montreal being in Quebec meant to me. But then when I see the type of racism, the type of oppression, even against faith-based individuals. Mm-hmm. When I saw people having to leave their programs because they were like, oh, I can't be a police anymore because I'm Muslim. I can't wear my hijab. I'm like, 2020 what? That is what's amazing to me. And I think of young people watching this when you had that educator, I think her name was Miss Fatima, and little kids from grade two were writing notes to their teacher because she had to leave her job because of her hijab. And I'm in that moment, my daughter's 18. I'm like, I am so glad I'm not having any more kids.
Yeah.
How am I saying that now?
Yeah.
Yeah, little kids like, I don't know why you had to leave us. You're my favorite teacher. And they're crying. I'm like, man, I could not be that parent explaining to my child why Miss Fatima no longer has a job. Mm-hmm. And imagine, this is oppressed individuals. And as Black people, where you're a visible minority. Yes, there's visible minorities, but then there's visible minority mm-hmm. and how we're treated right away.
I really hate to cut you guys short because is such an important conversation that you're having. But just on an ending note, I want to pivot the conversation back to helping, just because you guys talked a little bit about anger, mm-hmm. and I think that anger is a really important emotion, but we need to like channel that anger back into community work like you guys are doing. So do you have any advice to the people listening about how you can start out with community work and what kind of where to start?
I'd say always start in your own backyard, start in your home, check in with your friends. I'd say if anyone right now, if you have your phone next to you, just texting someone, seeing how they're feeling, mm-hmm. and not just after a traumatic moment, how are you really feeling? Because as Anglophones, we tend to, as my friend highlighted, we say, hey, how are you doing? Hi, how are you? And we keep moving. Mm-hmm. There is no time more better than the present to just say, how are you feeling? And let someone know that you're actually listening. And I say that because that's first mental health check. Mm-hmm. Checking in on someone, checking on yourself. And that's the first thing you could do is checking with your family, see if someone needs some support, your neighbor, start in your own backyard.
Yeah, I would say, as my brother would say, show compassion. You know, if you can go beyond empathy and really show compassion for everyone, I think that's kind of like the first step. And, you know, practice meditation, yoga, whatever you have to do to come back within. And I don't know, drink water.
Hydrate, ground yourself. Yeah. Definitely. I use the words anchoring. I tell myself to anchor. Mm-hmm. And also things that you see out there that are triggering. Ask yourself what you can honestly do in that moment. Mm-hmm. And there's certain things we do not have control over. Like when I see what's happening in these different countries where there's war, because Ukraine's not the only one. Consistently when we see these things, how can I serve my community best is first knowing that, okay, I have to have the oxygen mask on myself first.
Yeah. And learn when to turn it off. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Unplug.
It's like, I don't watch the news either, but I'm bombarded by social media, right? Learn when to put the phone down and just read a book, watch a movie, watch some comedy. I don't know. So that's what that's my suggestion.
Yeah. And move from anger, and you can be hurt. Recognize it. As I have moved up beyond the anger, the rage, that's part of desensitizing myself. But what do I replace with? It's nature. I move. I walk outside. I go on nature because guess what? Nature is still flowing as if the world is not jacked up. You hear the birds. You see the water. I live near the rapids. And I just watch nature, and that becomes the reset for me. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Be in flow.
Yes. Thank you guys so much for coming in. It was a pleasure to have you. And I really hope we get to continue this conversation at another time.
Love to. Thank you for having us.
Yeah, no worries. And I heard maybe soon you'll leave. Excuse me, Lord, if you have tricks up your sleeve. I'm not ready to be bereaved. I know I'm always asking for something or another, but this time, it's just time. Cause I love her. I just love her. Well, baby, if he don't change his mind, or fate, or time, yeah, I wanna leave you with this line. Twisted.
the faith if you feel me. It goes by you here. I wanna tell you some. SOS to your ears, the only thing I ever feared was this day.
Me and my girlfriend
down the ride to the very end. It's me
Hello, it is Luca again, and today we're here with Matthew Molinaro. He has written a piece for the McGill Tribune, and it is amazing, really, about the humanities, and he's here to talk about it with us today.
Yeah, hi everyone. Thank you so much for having me, Luca. Really excited. And just a little bit more, I'm an opinion editor at the McGill Tribune. I also work with the BSN and for the McGill Journal of Political Studies. So essentially, when I started writing my article, I was interested mostly in the relationship between the idea of the humanities and blackness and just being a person of color within the humanities, especially as often you're not represented in the syllabus. So two of my opening sentences are actually from two of my favorite black writers. One is from Toni Morrison, and I just changed it a little. It's "The Humanities Graduate Was Spiteful," so that's from Beloved. And one of the other ones was "How Do I Turn From My Degree and Live?" That's from one of Derek Walcott's poems. And yeah, so essentially one of the questions that I'm really interested in is the way in which we can actually make the humanities represent the plural nature of it. It's not humanity, right? It's humanities. But like the plural nature of it actually like takes away from the fact that it's not equal ground when we talk about the humanities. So at McGill, for example, things like philosophy don't put as much a focus on black philosophy or Africana philosophy. And in English literature as well, there are no diversity requirements within the program. So you'll get something like a course that's perhaps on one black author, and that can count, but it's not necessarily something you have to do. So one thing that I just found interesting was the fact that colonialism, you can get a degree at McGill in the humanities without actually studying colonialism, understanding racism, understanding your part in it as well. But the humanities itself is also, it's a privilege to study the humanities. And I think that should be said, first of all. And I go into in the piece because, one, if to study the humanities, you have to have like the class standing and able to like to be able to do that. And it comes as such a privilege to like learn about like Marxist literary theory or cultural theory without actually like being exploited by the nature of your class. Or it's also a privilege to learn like about black studies without having gone to a protest or something like that. So that's something I'm interested in, because a lot of the approaches to decolonizing the humanities have taken the approach of just thinking if you add one black author to the syllabus, that that's enough. And that, you know, that's something that's so casual about McGill too, is that they'll take any kind of conversation that we have about anti-racism and bring up perhaps that they teach Toni Morrison, or that, you know, like you can take courses on this, or even in the ABR, the Anti-Black Racism Plan, one of the strategies is to hire more black professors. And that's so important. You look at like political science, by next semester, there'll be 4 black professors in the department. But at the same time, there's a question of how we actually change the culture of it too, and make sure that we're not perpetuating systems of just supporting black excellence and the people who can make it all the way through university, because to get a PhD takes all that time. And even just to get into universities, and then also the fact that a lot of the times hiring committees place so much pressure on having an Ivy League degree. But then again, if you look at like the affirmative action cases that are coming before the Supreme Court, you know how difficult it is to get into Harvard if you're not a legacy student or if you're not incredibly rich. So there's a lot of different things that need to be done. And one thing that I'm really interested in is, and I realize that I'm saying interested in, but it just so happens that that's just what I'm interested in, is just interdisciplinary work. And that's something that's central to Black studies. In that, and we heard with the last guest too, that you can't really just understand like the Black experience by just focusing and targeting one discipline. For example, African American literature is not enough to actually understand the fullest nature of what the Black experience is in like the diaspora. So for example, when you consider like this move towards Black studies in Canada, so Queens has done really, really well. I mentioned Catherine McKittrick. It's like this amazing Black feminist thinker. She's a cultural geographer as well. Like their focus on Black studies is really one in which they take into consideration the sciences. They take into consideration social sciences as well. So you have anthropology, things like environment as well. In like this study of global Black studies, it's really interesting. And for humanities as well, it's incredibly difficult to take courses from like different departments for your own degree. For example, in English, you're only really allowed to take a few courses outside of the department, but often things like Canadian studies offer Black studies courses. And I'm one thing that's just so important is breaking down those barriers, because in the article, we go kind of into like the idea of disciplines as like a colonial construct, like the fact that any kind of knowledge can be synthesized into one category is very confusing as to why people would want to do that unless they're just trying to support certain voices which are overrepresented. So a lot of interdisciplinary work there is so important, but also breaking down like the meaning of disciplines. I think that can be done, but it also takes like a concerted push from scholars as well, who have often been very hesitant. You'll see that at McGill. McGill often likes to play up the fact that it's a very liberal university, but there are still like very conservative stalwarts. It's very difficult to get tenure at McGill if you're doing this kind of critical creative work. You look at someone like Dr. Charmaine Nelson, she's spoken about the obstacles that McGill threw at her so that she couldn't get tenure. For example, when time came to get chair of the department, people went above and beyond to go find someone else instead of her when it was rightfully her turn. So you just see how difficult it is there to get that done. And another thing is just about how the humanities like inspire critical thought that is just vital to why I study it, why I think people should study it, why people should care about what the humanities does outside of like its internal self. Because we were just talking about Bill 21. And often you hear from the premier of Quebec that there is no systemic racism in Quebec. And we often hear these kind of conversations about cancel culture that are huge in the United States, but are really making their way up into Canada. You'll see that with the Conservative Party taking on the Freedom Convoy, for example, and really trying to make that into this wedge issue that it isn't. But if you're limiting critical thought, then you're limiting the possibility for people to be able to challenge what governments are doing to keep them to account. And that's very much a pinnacle of democracy. So the humanities are able to do that, especially in science as well. I think one of the things that we have to consider is humanities, when I write about the humanities, I don't want them to be better than anything else. I just want it to be considered on equal ground. I think science has had such an influence on the humanities. If you look at the medical humanities, but also if you look at the way in which environmental racism and environmental humanities are really intermixed, that critical approach to the humanities can be absolutely like helpful to understand questions of environmental racism that aren't often taught in like typical environmental science and environmental studies programs. So that is just like something that I find like so interesting as well. But also because in science often, like people only really learn about like Black contribution to science when like a huge like movie comes out, or like cultural production on it too. Like if you think of Hidden Figures, for example, that's when people actually knew that like Black people can actually do stuff in the sciences. But also when you take this approach of saying that there's no systemic racism in Quebec, you forget the fact that Quebec's healthcare system is a systemically racist institution. One thing that we actually editorialized at the Tribune on was about how they like forcefully sterilized a Black Haitian woman. And the questions of consent was just such a gray area. But when you're not saying that there's systemic racism, you can also consider the death of Joyce Equichon 2 years ago. Like these are really questions that the humanities like to answer and like to criticize, and make sure that we're actually like bringing them to the forefront. And I think that's kind of the most that I have about the humanities. And I'm really open to kind of any questions whatsoever about the humanities, about McGill, and also student journalism.
Mm-hmm. So like I asked you to come on today because I was really interested in how you became like decided to go on the Tribune and how you got that position there. Yeah. So I just wanted to ask you, how did you really get into the humanities? Were there any authors that influenced you a lot? Or how did you get into this kind of humanity versus like Black activism?
Yeah,
like,
sure. Space? Yeah. I'll start like just from the beginning. So I actually didn't start in the humanities. I started in management. And then just because management at McGill allows you to take so many different electives, I kind of turned off of it when I took a post-colonial literature course that was taught by the English department. And that just got me really interested in questions of undisciplining and interdisciplinary work and the relationship between like politics and poetics. In humanities, though, I've just always loved to read, love to write, want to change the world. And the humanities likes to really like take those onto the forefront. Authors-wise, that can be kind of difficult. I actually, like, came up with just a few, so I make sure that I didn't forget them. But, like, people like James Baldwin, Langston Hughes. And I had the privilege of writing on Langston Hughes last semester for one of my classes. Someone like Roxane Gay as well. She, like, has really, like, risen up as, like, a cultural, like, commentator. But it's just been cool seeing her evolution for a few years. Like, if you consider just Black, Bad Feminist, a lot of her, like, also her short stories are just really interesting. But also, like, Toni Morrison. I'll say it, like, a million times. She is a gifted craftswoman. Like, she's a skilled technician of the English language. And I hate when she's only brought up for these, like, meaningless diversity requirements only because it doesn't mean that just because you have a Nobel Prize and a Pulitzer Prize doesn't mean that that's the only reason you should be included. And she's just one of the best authors, period. Yeah, so those are some of the authors. But getting into it, and in the relationship between that and Black activism, something you'll see in the humanities is the second you bring up, like, diversifying, you'll bring up decolonizing, you'll bring up Black studies, it's, oh, it's too political. And, like, well, because you're doing that, you're actually not focusing on the art. But this is just kind of a problem, like, generally, is the fact that, like, two things can be true at the same time. You can be doing political work, and you can be doing work that comes from the ground up, from people saying that we need to, like, decolonize the academy. We need to make sure that we're, like, focusing in on the fact that the academy often perpetuates this, like, white supremacy. It perpetuates systemic racism. And at the same time, you can also be focused on, like, the activism side of it. One thing that I said just in the, like, the article is often you just hear that people learn that people are different from reading a Black author, for example. Like, you read Toni Morrison, you learn that the fact that, like, oh, slavery actually, like, continues in different institutions, like mass incarceration. But it doesn't just stop there. You don't just get a humanities degree. You don't just take a humanities course and not reorient your view. And you don't, and you have to be able to have those kind of conversations both in your mind, but out in the world. So you want to take that first step of engaging with a book if you're not already, like, engaged in the on-the-ground activism. Then you start talking to people. And that's when, you know, this kind, when you talk across a difference too, that's something that's so important too. Like, you want to be working in solidarity, and then you can get out there as well if you're not already just working on Black activism. But I've been lucky as well, just because I do, like, I have obviously been at protests, I've spoken at protests, and just had that, and I've been able to kind of balance the two. But I know it gets very difficult, but that often is just the challenge of tackling, like, white supremacy at an anti-Black institution. Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to ask you a little bit about the challenges of Blackness in humanities. Do you think there's ever any point where Black literature can be a detriment to humanities or vice versa?
Yeah, so one of the questions is, like, whether it's even worth it. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the questions I ask myself. Okay, if I'm going to change it, do I really think that the values that it imparts are actually important? So I often try and, like, separate ideas from, like, the people who've upheld them. But for example, like, one thing that I often get is, like, a criticism, and it's a totally fair criticism about Black literature, is, well, if you're spending all this time reading, then you can't actually, like, do something out in the world. And that's totally fair. But often, like, that can be a touch point for you to, like, start moving. Like, people often talk about how, like, reading, people like Alice Walker, and it was even the same for me, like, you finally start to, like, relate with characters, and you relate and you see yourself as a Black person. Or even just for other people, like, you start to finally, like, be able to make that step and move into someone else's worldview and see from another person's perspective. And that's really important. But, like, the humanities themselves, like, the question of whether, like, Black literature alone, I think Black literature and, like, Black feminists have talked about this, like, at length. The question of, well, Black literature is so important, but we also have to remember that Black people express themselves in various different forms. Like, if you consider, like, rap, for example, you consider, like, popular culture as well. There's hasn't been as much movement towards, like, incorporating, like, Black popular culture within the academy. And cultural studies, which was, like, pioneered by someone like Stuart Hall, who was, like, a Jamaican-British sociologist, like, that's so important because a lot of the criticisms of literature, for example, come from the fact that it's not, like, focused on, like, actual, like, real people and lived experiences. So I think just having that, like, back and forth between cultural studies, literature, but then other humanities as well, like, it's important to understand that movements are grounded by philosophies, for example, So when you study Black philosophy, there's often that like activism component of it as well. And that can like change the way you like you act within the world. But it becomes very difficult for me. And something I have to rack like my brain about is whether like it's important stuff just because there are such barriers within the academy. But I do think that Black literature in combination with other fields, like history, philosophy, language as well. Language is so important to talk about. Like I think that can be something that when it's put forward, when it's taken, and it's taken meaningfully too, it's not just done to virtue signal, it's not just done to prove that you've fulfilled some requirement for an anti-Black racism plan, like it's taken seriously. I think that's something that can change the humanities and at the same time allow you to like go out in the world with like a different perspective and change it, although the barriers are just so, although the barriers are just so large.
Mm-hmm. I'm just going to pivot a little bit to your experience here at McGill, working for the McGill Tribune. So can you just kind of explain what you do and how they allow your personally, your Black voice to be put to the fore?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So the first part is how I got started or what I do as well? Yeah, so I got started last year. Last year was the COVID year, like the serious COVID year. We didn't go to school in person at all. Mm-hmm. Not that this year isn't serious as well, but last year, this was one way of me trying to just connect, but also just get the voice out. Because at that point, like George Floyd was murdered. And there was like this huge movement on the ground about anti-Black racism. And we saw like the largest numbers of people in North America coming to the streets, and it was all across the world. Right, like even Antarctica, people like scientists were like they had like BLM like signs out. So I wanted to get my voice out, and I actually started in arts and entertainment. So that's kind of connected to opinion. I was a staff writer there. I had like the privilege of like covering a lot of Black events by my own choice. Like one of the first ones I did was Deanna Bowen. She's a Governor General Award-winning artist who highlighted a lot of the work that's been done in Vancouver by like Black artists there. And I would personally have not known about like the just the enormous and like such important like Black presence in that space, also just because often the West is taken out from discussions of Blackness. But yeah, I was able to write articles weekly at that point, or bi-weekly, and I would say definitely I brought different kinds of articles to the fore. Like you have an opportunity to pitch yourself, and like one of the pitches that I did was on like the Booker Prize, which is like prize winning culture is so interesting in the humanities as well. So actually last year was the first time a Black author had won the Nobel Prize since Toni Morrison, Abdulrazak Gurnah. He's English but also Tanzanian, and I questioned like what it means to actually like diversify prize winning culture. Like some people often say that the culture of taste and slavery are just interlinked. So someone like Simon Gikandi at Princeton has mentioned that before. But yeah, I was able to write about those kinds of things and cover different events and get really to know the Black community in Montreal, which was really important. And then from there, I applied to editor and I applied to editor. I actually got opinion editor, which is what I do right now. And one of my jobs is to cover like politics very closely in Montreal and the Montreal area. And when I've had the opportunity to write, I've been able to center like the Black experience, both by like writing like political analyses. So I wrote one about Patel Contant. He was a Black man who was accosted by the police. And there was just a lot of dynamics going on there. It was at the same time that there was just a lot of like verdicts coming out, like Kyle Rittenhouse's, for example. And I called it three verdicts, one unjust reality. And I was able to really like break that down in ways that weren't often represented in the opinion section, just because opinion is often one of those places. And it's true just of like the media generally, if you're giving your opinion, there has to be like a reason for you to do so. And the opinion section for a long time just didn't have that many Black contributors or Black voices or even Black editors, for example. And I just felt like really lucky, because when I enter a space that doesn't have a lot of Black people in it, the first thing I do is I look for my allies. And I was lucky. My managing editor is someone who is very focused on police abolition, who's someone who just cares like deeply about that, who studied the politics of race and housing policy. And this is someone who's been able to like push me forward And that's really important. That's something that you have to do when you enter a journalism space. You have to find these people who are willing to work with you and be your collaborators in the good fight. So I've written about that. I've also satirized about like the Black experience at the university. So actually in the same issue that my feature article came out, I wrote this piece called like How to Talk to the Only Black Person at Your Work. And I was able just kind of to like bring up that in a creative way, which has been really lucky. Like I've been able to like show the experience just in multiple ways. But one thing that comes with being an opinion editor is running the editorial boards. So we've been able to discuss like police abolition. So one of our pieces, and I've been like really lucky to be part of this progressive like turn, because often people don't know that the McGill Tribune used to be like the most conservative newspaper on like campus. Like the Daily is someone who's been against neoliberalism since like 1911, I think they like say sometimes on their newspaper. So just being able to like work on these kinds of pieces, we even had one out on Black History Month, and it had been a while since we had really all come together and discussed it, was just really important. And I've been happy to do that just because I do know that journalism like is a tool that can be used to justify violence against the Black community. That someone who interferes, like journalism can interfere within Black communities, and also has the ability to shape public conversations around race. And that's been just really, really important for me as I've come to McGill, as I've been at McGill, but also just because of the allegations and racism within like the student society of McGill University as well. It's just been interesting to be at like that inside perspective. And within the opinion section, there's just so much creativity that I'm allowed to have. And it's, yeah, it's just been a great experience.
Mm-hmm. I know in your article, you kind of flip the narrative that I see a lot in journalism. There is a narrative that promotes kind of Black trauma, and you kind of flip that. So I wanted to know what kind of narratives you see and what kind of narratives you want to promote with your journalism.
Yeah, so it's at a certain point, people have to recognize that the Black experience is not just one of trauma, but at the same time not prioritize Black joy and this watered down version of Blackness that suits their own narratives. I just try and keep it like different. I try and keep myself open to different perspectives and to continue learning myself as well, because that's something, especially as like the only Black person in space, is to recognize that I cannot represent the entire community. I can't represent all the different perspectives, but I try, and when I can, I try to focus on issues that I think will be relevant in our like certain cultural and political moment. And so last year I was really lucky to cover this event with like four Black authors. So I covered, it was like Jael Richardson, Zalika Reed Benta, who wrote Frying Plantain. It's an amazing book. Attorney Murtis was also there. And she's wrote this, they said this would be fun, about Western University, which is a really great book. I could probably talk about that one for an hour. And then also there was Francesca Equiasi, who's from, she's from Halifax. And it's been really great to both like spotlight like Black art when I can, but also make sure that like I'm also uplifting voices in my, when I opine on certain issues. So I try and do the spectrum as best as I can. But often it just becomes, I also have to, in journalism, you have to consider what it means to be like the storyteller yourself. Because often when I report on like my own community, when I opine on them, it's like a tough thing. Like you can't, like it's not just something you can bang out in like an hour or 2 hours. It's something that you have to deeply consider. So it's a question that's like something I still have to ask, because to show just Black trauma in our paper means that we are giving this one narrative of Blackness. So at the same time, to show those multiple narratives, we have to like commit to making sure that we're more equitable across the ground. And there's been some really great work this year and over the past couple of years to get that going. And it's still an ongoing, like, it's a still ongoing fight, not just for myself, but for the paper as a whole. And I'm really proud that they've been working towards that, because it's just, it's been so many years, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I just want to ask a little bit more about kind of the purpose of writing and reading. So when you read a work or when you write a work, is there a specific, like, thing in mind when you're writing, or do you want, like, Black audiences to feel something in comparison to other POC or other races?
Yeah, for me or for just everyone?
Just, you know. Just,
yeah, you know. That's tough. Yeah. Yeah, because it's like, on the one hand, I want to make sure that, like, if I'm the only, like, Black writer and I'm, like, recognizing this and I'm, like, saying that I'm recognizing, like, the privilege to be able to do that, that I'm actually, like, writing, like, to them and for them. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not diluting my own voice so mm-hmm. that it only, like, supports that, like, what people actually think, like, the Black experience is like and what they think, like, my opinions on it will be. So that's a good question. I would say, like, I try, like, especially with my satire, I try to make sure that, like, Black and, like, POC audiences will like it, hopefully, yeah. versus, and use that as a way to, like, criticize, like, often, even good intention, like, white people. Obviously, we know about the problems of progressive white people, progressive white liberals. So I try.